Well, the last thing I'm going to read is some selections from the last essay that I did for Harper's Magazine, and that is the heart of the nonfiction book that I'm working on now. This book is I think of it as a weave of three strands of personal reportage of time that I have spent in Buddhist and Christian monasteries, of scholarship, of the evolution of the contemplative tradition from its origins in the East in Buddhism through Christianity to the present, and finally a personal essay about this virtue called faith. And I guess a word about how I got interested in that in the first place. I mean, I could tell the stories, the funny stories about monks hiking over the hills to come and rope me into this process that involved the Dalai Lama and whatever, but really the origin of the story was because I grew up in a large family. There were many women in the family. There was a lot of suffering in the family. As anybody who grew up on a farm knows, farming is the most dangerous occupation. And there was a lot of injury and death. There was alcoholism, all of the usual travails that befall a large rural family. And I asked the women and the older women in my family, how did you get through? What sustained you? And the word that they would invariably respond was faith, not Jesus, not going to church, but faith. And at some point, I started thinking, what does this mean? What does it mean to me as a, certainly I thought of myself, think of myself as a skeptic in a way, certainly a liberal humanist. What does the word faith mean? And that started a journey that turned into this Harper's essay. So I'll read from that. Before I plunge into it, just a last word of since I'm writing about faith, about fate and destiny as well, it is great to be, it's pretty amazing to be here with Jim, and I can tell you that everybody in San Francisco attributes it to the flight talent and energy, a creative energy from the city that is happening now. And they see Jim and I being here. They point to that. Someone wrote a column in the Bay Guardian in which they mentioned Jim and I as the examples of the departure of creative energy from San Francisco. So I won't speak about that, but I can say that it, I just wanted to say before reading this last bit how great it is to be here with Jim. And again, thanks to the university for making that happen. This essay got an enormous amount of response. It was pretty amazing. I think Harper's was amazed. I was certainly amazed. But all you need to know, I guess, it's self-explanatory, except that it started out with at a convocation of Buddhist and Christian monks, which I attended, and it evolved into this book project. There are some parts of it that are deep, but I will read slowly. Geography is destiny. European and Asian ways of being first mingled in the aptly named Middle East, which served as incubator of the West's great spiritual traditions, Judaism and its children, Christianity and Islam, all three influenced by Asian philosophies, Zoroastrianism, Buddhism, transported along with silk and spices over the great trade routes. That's a long sentence, but there's a contention in it that is self-evident when you start looking into this, the refusal of the West to acknowledge its roots in the East. Contemplative life, monasticism came from India. There's no question in my mind that that is where this whole contemplative tradition originated. It's possible to argue, the several authoritative people that I know have argued that that Plato and the origins of Greek philosophy have their origins in principles of Buddhism, and certainly you see in Plato many senses that could be lifted word for word out of Buddhist, early Buddhist texts. And when you think about the fact that there were everything else was going back and forth along those trade routes. Why were not ideas being exchanged as well? And yet the West steadfastly will not acknowledge that interconnectedness. Now in America, the circle is almost circled, to quote Walt Whitman, and the two great ways of being meet again, the westward migrating Judeo-Christian-rooted democratic idealism of 18th century Europe is encountering the eastward migrating ways of Buddhism. The religion of the word is encountering the philosophy of silence. I am brought to ask if the encounter in America of these Western and Eastern disciplines may hold the key to a legitimately American faith. Faith, not at all the same as belief. Zen philosopher Alan Watts explains the difference. Belief is the insistence that truth is what one would wish it to be. Faith is the unreserved opening of the mind to the truth, whatever it may turn out to be. Faith has no preconceptions. It is a plunge into the unknown. Belief clings, but faith lets go. Faith is the essential virtue of science, and likewise of any religion that is not self-deception. My travels among American monasteries have brought me to write not about belief, but about faith, not about doctrine, the virgin birth, the infallible pope, reincarnation, but about the subsuming of the self to the greater order. Watts contends that belief in God contradicts faith because God, conceived as omnipotent power, necessarily stands between ourselves and complete letting go. To argue as much is to ignore the role of belief as a means to the end of faith, usually expressed in metaphor, the burning bush, the resurrected Christ, the reincarnated essence of being. Belief challenges us to imagine and embrace a universe larger than what we immediately perceive. It engages a community in a collective imaginative act, one of the most powerful ways of binding people into a shared identity. Which is where the trouble begins. When communities use belief not as an aid to faith, but as a means to establish identity, sooner or later the guns appear. Catholic, Jew, Protestant, Sikh, Buddhist, Hindu, Muslim. These are powerful labels, easily used to identify and take up arms against the other. This is the challenge facing institutionalized religions if they are to be vehicles for peace. The teaching of belief as the outer garment of faith, a means to the end, but not to be mistaken for, and finally not essential to, the real thing. But what is the real thing? The question is central, the path of this journey. For skeptical Americans, children of a nation born of the union of religious idealists and Enlightenment rationalists, what does it mean to have faith? And so I return to the monks, the keepers of faith. After 8 children, my parents ran out of ideas for names, so they gave me over for naming to the Trappist monks at the Abbey of Gethsemane, a crow's mile across the Kentucky hills. In the 1950s, the Trappists more rigidly observed the rules of silence and mortification of the flesh. They spoke only at prayer or in emergency. They slept on straw pallets in unheated rooms. They fasted on not much more than bread and water throughout Lent and on All Fridays. My father, a maintenance worker at a local distillery, delivered to the monastery the bourbon the monks used in the fruitcakes they baked and sold to raise money. The monks appreciated my father's studied casualness in counting the bottles. For his part, my father preferred their company to the responsibilities of parenting his sprawling brood. Within months of their acquaintance, some of those monks became regulars at our dining table. Through various subterfuges, they slipped from the abbey to make their ways to our house, managing to arrive just before supper. They got pork chops, we got fried bologna, but still as children we adored their company. For the most part they were educated men, Yankees from impossibly exotic places, Cleveland, Buffalo, who stayed late into the evening drinking beer, smoking cigarettes, watching football on television, and talking. One brother was fond of a grass skirt someone had sent my mother from Hawaii. When the moon was right and the whiskey flowing, he donned the skirt and some hot pink plastic lays, then hoisted my mother to the tabletop and climbed up after. There she sang Hard-Hearted Hannah, the vamp of Savannah, GA, while her partner swayed his hips and waved his hands in mock hula. Later he launched into Broadway tunes, warbling in falsetto with his arms thrown around one or more of his brethren. Brother Fenton, my namesake, was a baker who made elaborate cakes for each of my birthdays until I was five. Then he left the monastery and disappeared from our lives for reasons I would not learn for many years. And there's much intervening history and analysis and scholarship and reportage. Shortly after I turned 16, my namesake Brother Fenton returned to visit my family and his old friends at Gethsemane. We received him and his handsome companion with the usual hospitality and food and drink. Monks came over. There was dancing on the table. We trotted out the grass curtain and plastic lays for my mother's dancing partner, now in need of a stool to climb to the tabletop, but otherwise as sinuous and campy as ever. Afterward, I listened for the customary post-party gossip. Had Fenton arrived with a woman, the household would have been abuzz. Who is she? Might they get married? Had he brought a mere friend, there would have been idle chatter. Nice man. Needs a haircut. But nothing. My namesake and his companion might never have sat at our table. In my small town, among garrulous Southerners, only one subject invoked a silence so vast and deliberate. That night I went to bed understanding that Fenton and his companion were lovers, which meant that I was perhaps not the freak of nature I had believed myself to be. I was not alone. Each of us must find for himself or herself the wellspring of faith. To judge from their devotion to the Virgin Mary, many women find that place through their gender. For me, it resides in the source of my otherness, my homosexuality. It is interesting that I think the reason why Timothy, the abbot at Gethsemane, acceded to this. I have to ask him in our interviews, which now extend over 3.5 years, get more and more frank, which is what, you know, it's the longest time I've worked to get. But I think what he will say when I ask him in the last time that we talk, he's retiring, why he was so free at asking me to come back is partly because he's a liberal Catholic, and I think he is angry at what's happening in the church, and he thought that, and in institutionalized religion across the board, and he thought that this was some way to do something about it. But I guess if fate is maybe the theme of the evening, I think he also recognized what he didn't say no, you know? He was a man of faith, and he felt that even if it produced difficult knowledge for him to have to deal with, that this person had been brought there and he had to say yes. And I was very touched by that, needless to say. Now we get to the deep and interesting part. Several months after the Gethsemane convocation, I talked with Norman Fisher, co-abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center. A fully developed imagination enables us to live in a world that's ennobling without dwelling in some fantasy land, he said. A fully developed imagination enables us to live in a world that's ennobling without dwelling in some fantasy land. That's wisdom. For, he said, for a Buddhist, enlightenment is the development of the faculty of imaginative vision that enables us to see the world in a transfigured way. For a Buddhist, enlightenment is the development of the faculty of imaginative vision that enables us to see the world in a transfigured way. He looked up from his black Zen robes. That's what a Catholic Mass is about, right? And when he said that to me, it was one of those moments when you interview somebody and I thought, oh, it all, I get it. I understand. But it was a really wonderful moment. And of course, I have it all in my notes. And I go back and talk to Norm, and he says, I don't remember saying that at all. So fortunately, it's in my, take good notes is the, he looks up from his black Zen robes. That's what a Catholic Mass is about, right? The Mass. You enter the Gethsemane Abbey Church, high and long and narrow, whitewashed brick, plain as an empty hand, whose lines direct your eyes forward to the dais, on which sit two vertical blocks of black granite, topped by a horizontal slab lit from above by a spotlight. Behind this altar stands the starkest of thrones, six flat planes, a back, a seat, two arms, two armrests of polished oak. To either side, ranks of monks robed and cowled. You have entered the theater of faith. The setting prepares you for blood sacrifice. What you get is art. It is 1,998 years into the Christian era, 6,000 years into the era of self-consciousness, and we are here to bear witness to the triumph of the imagination, the great human achievement, the acting out of mystery in metaphor instead of in fact. Transubstantiation, the bread becomes flesh, the wine becomes blood. We eat the flesh and drink the blood, and so reenact the violent heart of the mystery of being. To teach literal transubstantiation as the focal point of this genuine miracle is to take the narrowest view on the greatest work of ongoing performance art Western civilization has conceived. It is to collude with secularism in assigning the miraculous to the past, when in fact the spark of the divine resides in the present imagination, in the leap of faith required to conceive and achieve science, art, the Catholic Mass. It is that facility and faculty of imagination that is the genuine and continuing miracle that organized religion so often quashes as antithetical to the ends of institutionalized power. I take an imaginative leap here to see consciousness as evolving from those first hermit monks of India through Plato, who understood unity with the whole of being as the soul's aspiration and goal. We move from the era of prophets who ascribe the mystery of being to external agents, gods and demons, to prophets, Buddha, Jesus, who direct us to the sacred place within. We move from an era when the acknowledgement of mystery demanded blood sacrifice. Less than 500 years ago, the Aztecs built a brilliant civilization around it, to an era in which we are clever enough to substitute bread and wine and understand it as the real thing. The quality we draw upon to accomplish this imaginative leap, this act of confidence in our human right and responsibility to shape the terms of our encounter with the divine, as well as confidence in the greater order in which our search takes place, we give the name of faith. The quality we draw upon to accomplish this imaginative leap, this act of confidence in our human right and responsibility to shape the terms of our encounter with the divine, as well as confidence in the greater order in which our search takes place, we give the name of faith. Must rationalism obviate faith? Science without religion is lame, wrote Einstein. Religion without science is blind. Contemporary physics is rediscovering the revelation that mystical, often monastic writers repeatedly present as the culminating fact of the contemplative life. The understanding that science and art lead to mystery. Finally, we can only glimpse the great unity with an understanding increasingly supported by scientific evidence, but sustained by a leap of faith. Immersed in and part of this great river of energy, we live every instant the precise analog of the moment of transubstantiation in the Catholic Mass, in which the transcendent order is at once revealed and concealed. Seen in this light, faith does not divide but unifies body and spirit, perception and miracle, science and spirituality. Faith is first among the cardinal virtues because everything proceeds from it, including and especially love. Faith is the leap into the unknown, the entering into an action or a person knowing only that you will emerge changed, with no preconception of what that change will be. Its antonym is fear. In the prosperous 1990s, America is a fearful society. Consider our obsession with national security, financial security, emotional security. Because we are a faithless society, Without faith, without that willingness to embrace life, including its uncertainty and pain and mortality and mystery, the soul becomes stagnant, possibly the only aspect of the universe that can resist change, and in resisting change, possibly the only aspect of the universe that can really die. Faith accepts that we cannot know everything and control, and can control only a little. If we can bring that acceptance to science, if we can recognize science as existing on a continuum with art, if we can embrace both not as a means to the accumulation of money, sex, and power, but as done for the sake of the love of knowledge, which is to say the love of beauty, which is to say the love of truth, we will have reason to hope. In paling darkness, the Shusho, it's the woman who wakes you up in the morning, makes her circuit through the Tassajara Canyon, ringing the wake-up bell with the self-satisfaction of a young woman awake and given the pleasure of rousing everyone else. In silence, your neighbors struggle into their black robes. Outside, a waning moon sets over the dark, ragged line of the mountains, egg into nest. The moonlight knits shadows of branches on a glistening carpet of wet leaves. The black-robed monks hurry to the meditation hall, where later you will join them. But on this particular morning, you walk past the hall and up the canyon, beyond the kerosene lamps. You follow your nose past sage and under California Bay laurel to the sulfurous spring, heated in the bowels of the earth. You drop your clothes and step in. An early sprouting big leaf maple drips catkins into the chill. A middle-aged man, pudgy at the waist, thinning at the crown, rises from the pool. He arches a hand over his head, first to the right, then to the left. Then he bends at the waist, then straightens, stacking his vertebra one at a time until his head lolls back to one side, then another. He raises his arms and you see stiffness rising from his ruddy, steaming skin. Crepuscular light passes through the curling steam, and it's as if an angel has stepped from the cold, rushing stream below through the heated waters and into the brightening, dappling light. And for a moment, you are given to understand that you are that angel, that man, above the rushing water, that here and now you are made in the image of the divine, that paradise is a mirror in which you see yourself, that what we have to become is what we already are. Thank you.